I'm Mark Simpson, and this is Intersection. It looks like Florida will not be building a high-speed rail line between Tampa and Orlando after all. The Florida Supreme Court ruled late last week that Governor Rick Scott did not overstep his authority when he rejected $2.4 billion in federal high-speed rail money last month. The governor marked his rejection of the rail money by announcing a new initiative to expand the Port of Miami for ultra-large ships that will start moving through an expanded Panama Canal. More on that coming up. And we listen back to my conversation with the editor of the Orlando Sentinel, Mark Russell. That's ahead on Intersection. Dredge, baby, dredge. That was the statement on Governor Rick Scott's Twitter feed after he told U.S. Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood that Florida would indeed pass on $2.4 billion in federal money to build a high-speed rail line between Orlando and Tampa. Governor Scott says his $77 million plan to dredge the Port of Miami will create 30,000 new jobs and be ready for the refurbished Panama Canal when it starts taking the new Panamax ships in 2014. There's also been a little buzz on Twitter about private investors building a rail link between the Orlando International Airport and Walt Disney World. Nothing confirmed yet on that. We'll keep you posted on the buzz. Visit us at WMFE.org/intersection, or you can send an email to intersection@WMFE.org. Coming up, we listen back to my conversation with the editor of the Orlando Sentinel, Mark Russell. This is Intersection. Mark Russell got the job as the editor of the Orlando Sentinel in October of 2010 after serving in a number of high management positions at the paper. Before that, he worked for the Boston Globe and the Cleveland Plain Dealer. We spoke in November of last year. Mark Russell, welcome to Intersection.
Thank you, Mark. Glad to be here.
When you took over at the Sentinel as editor, you said you wanted to focus on local investigative reporting and increase the digital presence of the paper. This, of course, comes at a time when news staffs and especially newspapers have been hard hit by the down economy. Talk to me a little bit about how you want to tackle this goal while having lost a lot of people over recent years.
Absolutely, because I think that newspapers and news organizations, because we are really a newsroom that publishes information and content across many platforms, from mobile to the web, to, of course, we print a paper, ink on paper, every single day. And I think that people expect us to be the kind of operation that looks at huge watchdog stories and does accountability journalism, holds public officials accountable, does consumer watchdog stories. That's sort of, in many ways, the price for admission for a large newspaper, and we strive to do a good job. We could probably do even better on that. It's what people expect of us. But it's also our responsibility to cover our communities. We both live and work in a place that is vibrant and diverse, and I think we're one operation that can reflect that every single day in our pages. We can show people, give them a mirror on the region, if you will, and also describe some of the trends and the challenges in the region, describe the growth of, for example, the Latino community and the growing political leadership in that community. We can also talk a bit more about the growing African-American community in this town and describe the challenges it faces as well, while not forgetting that people care a lot about stories that affect them where they live. So we have reporters from Maitland all the way to Mascot in this region, and we're going to continue to cover those stories very closely.
How do you focus on investigative journalism at a time when so many newspapers are having to cut back in their staffs, especially in those areas, because investigative mm-hmm. journalism takes a long time, and you have to devote a lot of resources into that?
Not all investigative journalism takes a long time. You can do investigative journalism as essentially a one-off story done by one reporter off a beat that may take a week or two. The projects take a long time, and we do fewer projects than we did 6 years ago, but we have not run away from our responsibility to do investigative journalism or do accountability journalism. And I'll give you a couple examples of that. One of the things we've done recently is we've done some stories on the Florida Blood Centers. Dan Tracy, one of our reporters who covers transportation, he has a beat, but he also is one of the more renowned investigative reporters in this region, has been there for two decades, and did a series of stories about the blood centers that I think really made for big difference for that agency and for the region, led to a new director coming in, led to an entirely new board coming in. I won't get into all the details of that, but that's a story that we did off his beat. We've also done some watchdog reporting from our columnists. Mike Thomas, for example, just had a series of columns on a young man in town, Edwin McFarland, who was arrested at a Burlington coat factory in Orange County. He was accused by cops of attempting to abduct a four-year-old girl.
By the Orange County Sheriff's Office.
Orange County Sheriff's Office. And it was actually, as the story developed, it became very clear to Mike and also to readers also, Mike Thomas, that he was wrongly accused of that he did not attempt to abduct a girl, but he was about to be charged. Those stories actually led to cops, sheriff's office dropping those charges, prosecutors deciding not to charge him. That was really watchdog reporting at its finest, in my view.
Talk to me about that, because Mike Thomas is a columnist. Mm-hmm. He's able to put his opinion out there in whatever capacity he likes in his column. How is that different than having a reporter do that kind of watchdog journalism? And is there a reason that you decided to let Mike Thomas run with the ball as opposed to putting a regular beat reporter on it?
That's a good question. Actually, the reason Mike Thomas ran with the ball is because Mike Thomas grabbed the ball. And we've got several columnists, Mike Thomas, Scott Maxwell, Mike Bianchi in sports, and others who occasionally decide to run with a ball like that. And I say, go for it. Those are the kind of stories that we expect columnists to do. They're some of our best reporters in the building. That's why they became columnists. And when they get their hands on a good story, like, they just run with it. So we expect columnists to occasionally break news. There's no prohibition against that at our paper or any other paper.
What about the use of opinion, though, in that type of reporting? Because the columnist has that option, which typically a reporter is not allowed to have those freedoms of an
right.
opinion.
I think in the case of Mike Thomas, using the case of the kid, Edwin McFarland, for example, he has a point of view. An obvious point of view, and I think readers know that. They see that his work is labeled commentary, so they know he has a point of view. But he also can break news, and he also can do digging. And in that instance, he really did a really good service for the community as well as for that case, and certainly for that young man.
What do you have to watch out for when someone uses their opinion in that type of reporting?
I'm not sure you have to watch out for anything in particular. You have to make sure that they're being fair. And I think that's it's a key issue when someone is breaking news in a column or doing a breaking story. And I think in this instance, Mike did probably more reporting. In some cases, he may do more reporting than a reporter would have done in a story like that. So it is not to say that he's going to just go ahead and have an opinion without being able to back it up with facts. He had to back up everything he did in that series of columns at McFarland with facts. So he goes out and does his reporting, and then he backs it up with facts. But he also, in that series of columns, has a very demonstrated point of view, and that was that the sheriff's department and the prosecutors were on the wrong track. But it was based on his reporting.
You also mentioned that because of cutbacks in the staff of the Sentinel, you're able to do less and fewer of the in-depth projects that have been the hallmark of investigative reporting. Do you miss that?
Yes. We do fewer big year-long, six-month-long projects, and I think any medium-sized newsroom in a big city like ours would tell you that, because we have fewer people. We can't afford to dispatch someone detach someone for a year's time to do a big project. So I miss that aspect of it, you know, really being able to dig in and do something like that. But what I've been pleasantly surprised at is how the rest of the staff, folks who cover housing, folks who cover theme parks, folks who cover transportation, other folks who cover education, have leaped in and started doing short-term projects, ones that take maybe 2 weeks to a month, sometimes a couple months, in the absence of having the ability to do these year-long projects. Because we have a smaller staff, we just can't afford to do those kind of projects. But if we run across a story that, in our collective opinion, is worth that kind of time, I'll find a way. I'll find a way to detach somebody for a year to do it.
Is there a loss to the community in terms of the service the newspaper provides because of that smaller staff and having to have that different focus? Or is that just too nostalgic a vision to look back and say, well, those were the glory days of newspapers?
I'm not sure it's a nostalgic vision. And I think readers obviously make up their own minds about what they miss in a newspaper. I think some folks who read our paper will see that we are a bit more aggressive now on doing watchdog reporting on various agencies, be it public agencies, be it business, be it consumer watchdog stories, and they think that's a good thing. Others may miss the sort of reporting projects that take a year and that come out and run six, seven days in a row, they may miss those kind of things. I'm not sure I can determine whether that's a bad thing for the community. I think that because we've now been forced, as every other paper has, to be much more resourceful in how we do those kind of stories, and other reporters have become more aggressive on doing them, I think overall it's a net gain for the community.
We're talking with Mark Russell. He's the editor at the Orlando Sentinel and worked at numerous papers around the country. This is Intersection on 90.7 WMFE-FM. I'm Mark Simpson. Talk to me a little bit about how you want reporters to use technology in the newsroom and in these new types of more focus on community reporting and watchdog reporting that you've been talking about.
It's a very good question, and it's something that we've already begun doing in a big way and have been doing for going on now 2 years. I think you'll find most reporters in the newsroom are on either Facebook or Twitter, sometimes both, sometimes LinkedIn as well and Foursquare. They're using social media to sort of broadcast their content to a wider audience, people who don't pick up the paper, people who may not even go to our website on a regular basis. So we're getting a wider play for our content, stories, the photo galleries from concerts, things to do sections on things like the Florida Classic coming up here in town. We're getting much more wider play on those because of social media. I also think particularly reporters have become much more adept at using video cameras. And this is in addition to the photographers who are expert at doing this, but we have reporters now who are using video cameras. And on some stories, ones that have a real strong video component, they're coming back with not only the story for print, it goes online first, it's a digital first news operation, goes on digital first on the website, then it goes in print. But in addition, they're also producing a video package that gives people yet another way to tap into that story and to connect with it. So I'm excited about that. And it's a newsroom that early on, before I ever arrived here 6 years ago, was already beginning that sort of digital focus. You know, we were early to the whole game of having a broadcast station inside the newsroom and a partnership with Channel 13 at the time, which you no longer have. And we also have long been a place that valued convergence, or the convergence of both print and broadcast and internet.
Using that social media, Facebook, Twitter, these types of platforms, is there a different language that needs to be used by reporters than if they're writing a print story?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think people that use Facebook and Twitter on a regular basis clearly know that, A, you got to catch people's interest very quickly, so you can't have a long wind-up on Twitter or Facebook. In fact, on Twitter, you can't have a long wind-up at all. You have 140 characters, so you have a very short wind-up. But I think it's a bit more informal. It's a bit more in your face, and you've got to really try and capture people's interest quickly because you're getting hit with a lot of stuff on social media, and you want to stand out.
What does that mean for, I guess, both the writer and the reader of that language, more informal, more in your face? Does that run the risk of dumbing down news and information?
I don't think it does at all. You're actually connecting people to the content, both in the paper and on the website, that is the same content you find in the paper for the most part. But you're trying to do it in a way that catches their attention. So I'll use a quick example for you.
Does that mean sensational?
No, not necessarily at all. It means trying to get their attention. And that does not necessarily mean sensational, but I'll give you a good example of it. You know, we had a story, it was a small story inside the sports section. It was on some guy in Gainesville who had filed a restraining order against Tim Tebow, President Obama, and Jesus. And on the face of it, it's a ludicrous thing to even read and think about. But it's the kind of story that on web does very well because of those three characters. You don't see those three characters in a story very often. So on a story like that, if you're going to do a Facebook or Twitter post, you're going to do the obvious thing and say, Gainesville man files restraining order against Tim Tebow, Jesus, and Barack Obama. And most people are going to click on that because they're going to say, what do those three have in common? Now, in the paper, that's a story that's way inside the sports section. It's written to be basically a brief. It's not much of anything inside the paper. On the web, that story probably takes on a bit more of a life of its own. It goes a little bit more viral because of the three folks that are together in that sentence.
What do you think that says about the way people are using news and information, that something that you judge for the hard copy paper as being fairly small, fairly insignificant, does take on a life of its own in the internet and the digital arena. What does that mean for you as a journalist and the kind of reporting that seems to really grab people's attention? Does it move focus away from bigger issues?
No, I don't think it does at all. I think you have to recognize that people go to the web for different things than they do the paper. And you have a great many readers on the web who are just looking for things that are quick reads. They're not necessarily looking for in-depth stories on the web. If they were, we'd probably see some sites get more page views than things like TMZ, for example. So people go to websites to look for different things. And stories like that can play well on the web because folks have a real interest in reading things like that and seeing short clips on stories like that. So they do better.
What does that mean, though? Take me further into it as a journalist, because I'm fascinated by this idea, both as a reporter and as a user of news, that something like that takes on a life of its own. It gets more hits on the internet. What do you think that says about the interests of people these days, and how does it relate to, say, civic engagement? Because you could have a political story, maybe about the mm-hmm. governor and the future of the state of Florida, and maybe that doesn't get as many hits. So what does that say, I guess, as the way it all connects with the internet, the audience, and you, the provider of news content?
Sure. Let me try and answer it a different way, because we have two stories that are on today's front page that I consider really interesting, important stories that really connect very well with a print audience, and I think should connect well with a web audience. I haven't yet looked at the numbers to see how they're doing, but I dare say that the story about Jesus, Barack Obama, and Tim Tebow probably got more clicks than the two I'm going to mention. One is a story on the front page today about bank fees that are rising to new heights. Banks like SunTrust, and there's a SunTrust example at the top of the story, which is why I'm mentioning SunTrust first, where SunTrust is charging a lot more for bounced checks and other fees. And it's a way to, of course, make up for what they expect will be higher costs associated with some of the banking reform happening now. The other story, and that story also gives tips to people to try and avoid the high fees on bounced checks, for example. So it's a very good consumer story, sort of a watchdog story. It gives you very much things to improve your financial life. The other story is the so-called centerpiece on page one, the one that we give the most attention to. And it's a story about how Orange County Library System is about to start a new program to allow people to get and access more information on things like food stamps, unemployment, looking for jobs. A very user-friendly, consumer-focused story that I think is important for a market that's had still has a double-digit unemployment rate and still has very many people who are underemployed. I think those two stories, and it's why we put them at the top of the page today, are very important stories. On the web, I would be willing to bet you those things don't get as many hits as a story about Cam Newton, the Auburn University quarterback who's been accused of academic fraud at UF.
Mm-hmm.
Now, does that mean that the folks who are reading the Cam Newton story don't care about this one? They probably do, and they may get to it at some point throughout the day today. But the stories that tend to get looked at first are stories about personalities, the kind of quirky stories, the things that very quickly you can latch on to and access. And that's been that way for a while now.
But let me ask you this about the way you view these two audiences, the online audience and then the audience that looks at the hard copy newspaper. The difference is that to get maybe to the sports story that's deeper in the paper, you at least have to go through mm-hmm. some of those other stories on the front page and the other sections there. And in the online version of the Sentinel, that webpage changes
all day,
and certain stories rise to the top. What does that say about those two different audiences? Are you definitely going for two different audiences online versus in the hard copy?
Oh, absolutely. And I think on the you hit on it very well. On the web audience, it's a constant river, a stream of the content that changes all day, and we're programming the website and the mobile site very differently in terms of the kind of stories that will appeal to people early in the day when they're going to work or they're getting out of bed, they're looking into smartphones. You'll find more stories about traffic, more stories that really get people started in their day. And then we'll have a lot of stories midday when folks really, there's a spike in interest midday. Folks are at the office looking at the computers. They want to read stories about other people. They want to read stories. Maybe this is the case where a story like the library story or the bank fee story would probably do better middle of the day. And again, end of the day, you're programming once again some traffic stories, things to do for the weekend if it's a Thursday or Friday. Tonight there's a Magic game. We'll probably have a Magic story on our homepage starting about 4 or 5 o'clock because folks are thinking about the Magic. It's our only professional team, and it affects the life of downtown. That's a story that we played very prominently. So we do change that programming of stories throughout the day. It changes a lot.
You mentioned that river analogy, and I like that a lot. And I wonder, in that river of information that you see on the internet, there is the possibility that you don't see some of these other tributaries, maybe, of other stories out there. On the online site, the layout is different than actually looking at kind of the layout of the daily paper itself.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
What do you say about the risk that people might not stumble into another story, say maybe one about the governor or something like that, whereas flipping through the physical paper, you might come across that and it might catch your eye. But on the internet, it's so precise that you click on one story, you go right to that story. What is your view on that and the possibility that some of your maybe hardest reporting stories are missed by the online audience potentially?
Well, our numbers suggest they're not missed by the online audience and that we actually have more than a dozen channels, sub-channels, if you will, on our website. So we have a politics channel where we'll have stories about Rick Scott and about the incoming congressional leaders. Folks will find those on the political channel. We have a business channel where you'll find this story. It's called Money, a money channel where you'll find this story about the bank fees. We also have a series of other channels and blogs that we use to sort of convey that content. And people tend not to go to the homepage of OrlandoCenter.com. They tend to go to landing pages elsewhere on the site where they're going
directly
to find that kind of specific content.
Do you think they've got it bookmarked, or are they typing it in, or does it matter?
It probably both. Some have it bookmarked. Some type it in directly. Others have RSS feeds to specific bloggers that they want to read. Some people like reading Mike Bianchi every morning. Some like reading Mike Thomas or Scott Maxwell every morning. It depends on the interests of the person.
Does the story that appears on the homepage of the Orlando Sentinel, is that the most important story of the moment?
It's hard to define what's the most important story of the moment. I will say that it's the story that we think has great interest at the moment.
Tell me the difference between importance and interest.
Well, the Cam Newton story, I noticed this morning when I looked at the site, the Mike Bianchi column on Cam Newton was one of the top stories early this morning. And I'm sure that, as I mentioned, it got a lot of hits because it's an interesting story, whether you got it through the homepage or you got it through going directly to Mike Bianchi's column or the sports channel. It's a story of great interest. He's a Heisman Trophy candidate. Auburn is the number two ranked team in the nation behind Oregon. And he's a former UF player. So a lot of interest, a lot of UF graduates in this region, a lot of football fans. Football's a religion. Here's a big story. Is it the biggest story today? Not even close.
So what is your obligation then as a content provider to put up what is the most interesting or what is the most important?
I think our responsibility to do a little bit of both. And keep in mind that we're trying to build audience. We're trying to build engagement. There's a place on our website for both. So we'll have the Cam Newton story up there for perhaps the morning. And then we may program it differently midday and put the bank story up. We may change that out and put the story about the libraries up. But there's a way to do all that throughout the entirety of the day.
Do you ever hold a story for the hard copy version of the paper just to get it out there, you know, first in print, physically print, as opposed to publishing immediately online?
It's happening very rarely. In fact, I can't recall the last one we did that with. It may have been one on the Florida Blood Centers 8 to 10 months ago, but we seldom do it.
How come?
Because we really think that we're a digital-first operation, first off. And stories that go up on the web, even if they go up as late as 9 or 10 o'clock at night before publication, can serve as a way to drive interest to the print edition and have people come and look at that story in the print edition the next day and see other things through serendipity the next morning. And again, we're a digital-first operation, so we don't believe in holding stories on a regular basis for the print edition. We publish things on the web first, and then we pause in the afternoon and then at night, certainly late, to put out a paper.
Mark Russell is our guest. He's the editor of the Orlando Sentinel, and you're listening to Intersection on 90.7 WMFE-FM. I'm Mark Simpson. You mentioned Digital First, and you had a partnership at one time with Central Florida News 13, a local television operation. Do you perhaps see yourself leaning towards a collaboration more with another newspaper, or would it be some other media platform that has a strength in an area that you don't? Do you feel the need to build in an area where you're not as strong, or would you enhance in areas where you already have?
Sure. I can answer that question two ways. The first thing is we have a few partnerships already with other news organizations throughout Florida, and it's mostly a newspaper partnership. We have one with Florida Today, which, of course, is in Brevard County in Melbourne. We also have another partnership that's much more active, and that's with the St. Pete Times. We have shared stories with the St. Pete Times on Florida State and some on UCF, and they in turn have given us stories on USF, the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, and the Tampa Bay Rays when they were making their playoff run, especially this past year.
Why is it in sports?
It's a good way to share content because we have expert reporters and columnists who are covering statewide institutions and statewide teams, Florida State, for example. And that we have someone based in Tallahassee, which is an expensive proposition to have someone based in a community all year long who does nothing but cover sports for Florida State. He may do other things as well, but his primary responsibility is cover basketball, football, and baseball.
And as a Seminole, I have to say, you know, I appreciate that.
Okay, good. I'm glad to hear that. So it means that the that St. Pete Times doesn't have to have someone in Tallahassee covering Florida State. They can get our coverage, and it's going to be pretty good coverage. This guy, Andrew Carter, has been there for a few years. He's an expert. And in turn, we want to have some stories about the Buccaneers and the Rays. We don't run every story they have because our readership cares more about the Magic. But we don't have to have someone based in Tampa to cover those teams because the St. Pete Times is a very good news organization. So it's a way of saving money and being more efficient and using your resources.
Do you see that the Orlando Sentinel might be heading in the direction of charging for online content? The New York Times is expected to go that way here in Florida. The Tallahassee Democrat already charging for web content. Is the Sentinel going to be headed in that direction?
We've elected not to go in that direction because, of course, there are two models of how you make money online. And actually, you could even say three models, but the one model that we followed is to try and build audience and then sell that audience to advertisers. And you build audience more rapidly by having a site that is accessible to anyone. You can also gain more revenue from selling access to your website through a paywall. We've elected not to do that, and I don't see that changing anytime soon. We also, and you'll see this happening soon, I've developed a new iPhone site for the Orlando Sentinel, which is at the iTunes store right now. I'm not sure how long it takes to get it out the iTunes store. I'm not sure what kind of store that really is, but it takes a while to get it out of the store. And that's going to be a free app, so it won't cost anything to access that information.
That's Mark Russell, the editor of the Orlando Sentinel, speaking on Intersection in November of 2010. By the way, if you're interested, since we spoke with Mark Russell, that app for the iPhone is already out. Got something you want to share with us? Well, you can tell us about it on the Florida Talks blog. Visit WMFE.org/intersection to find out more. There, you'll also find links to our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners and from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I'm Mark Simpson, and thanks for listening.